I'd like to call to order the Health and Social Services Committee at 1:30 p.m. on Wednesday, March 29th, 2017. We're meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phone as a courtesy. Committee members present are Senator Geisel, Senator Baggett, Senator Machicki, myself, Senator Wilson. We may be expecting Senator Van Emhoff today. Today, Donna Logan from the McDowell Company and Jeff Jesse of the Mental Health Trust Authority will present an economic cost of alcohol and other drugs abuse in Alaska. We'd like to welcome Mr. Logan and Mr. Jesse, Mrs. Logan and Mr. Jesse to the front. And for committee members, it's for more of a dialogue today to go through the presentation. So if you have questions, please feel free to ask. And you guys may begin when you're ready. Please remember to state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the legislative liaison for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And with me...
I'm Donna Logan, and I'm vice president for Anchorage Operations for the McDowell Group.
And I'll introduce this presentation, and then we'll get right into it. The Mental Health Trust Authority has been interested in the economic costs of alcohol and drug abuse in Alaska for a number of years. The McDowell Group is an independent organization dedicated to objective research in a number of areas. So I want to stress that we did not direct them to come up with any predetermined answer. In fact, you'll see some data in here that was a surprise even to the trust. But we feel that this is important work because it starts to quantify what the costs to all of Alaskans are to alcohol abuse and drug abuse. And the numbers are quite staggering. The economic cost of alcohol abuse alone is $1.8 billion. The cost of drug abuse is $1.2 billion. Together, that's $3 billion in costs. Now, that includes lost productivity, traffic accidents, health care costs, criminal justice costs, child protection costs. The impacts of alcohol and drug abuse are felt across the entire economy, both at the private sector and in the public sector as well. So we think that as you are making difficult decisions around the budget, looking at how to reduce the cost to the state of different parts of government that at least arguably are trying to do something positive for the state, we need to start really looking at this area of cost and how do we drive down this cost of alcohol and drug abuse. To put this in perspective, the entire alcohol tax produces just less than $40 million a year. That's a $40 million tax to try to deal with a $1.8 billion problem. The tax has not been increased since 2002. It was not inflation-proofed, and those funds buy considerably fewer services today than they did 15 years ago. So with that, I'll turn it over to Donna to walk you through the report.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to move this just a little.
Yep.
Oh, maybe I'm not.
Yeah, we
I'll
can
just
do it.
Let's do it this way. Okay, that's fine. So I, there's a couple ways to do this, but I guess I would recommend to you, since we have time, that if there are questions along the way, I'm happy to take them along the way. But I know your time is precious, so we'll move as quickly as we can through this. So thank you. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the fact that this is the fourth generation that we've done of this study. And can you hear me okay? Should I move
yes,
this over?
Ma'am.
Okay. And with each generation, I think we're seeing improvements. And this generation in particular is quite a bit different than if you looked back at previous reports. We have much better access to data than we've had in the past. More of that data, there's more transparency around that data. It's easier to get a hold of. And some of the modeling has improved. We're reliant on modeling for this work. So I wanted to state that we think that this report has a lot of new information in it, and I think that it's more accurately reflects those costs than we've done previously, just because you're hampered by some of the availability of data. There are costs associated with alcohol abuse And those costs can be tangible and intangible. Tangible being medical costs, you know, cost loss of property. Intangible, though, a quality of life issues, pain and suffering, and so on and so forth. For the 1.8 billion figure that Jeff just mentioned does not include the intangible costs associated with alcohol abuse, only the tangible. There are a couple instances where we do have some of that intangible costs because we have some modeling around it, and I'll share that with you, but I wanted to emphasize that our total figure, the big number, doesn't include those intangible costs, which can be significant as well, as you know. So there's obviously a lot of different consequences of alcohol abuse, and so with that, we're looking at a wide range of impacts, and with that, we have to really resort to a lot of different data sources and a lot of different methodology to be able to capture that. So before I get into the methodology, I just, I think Jeff already said this, and I won't spend a lot of time on this slide, but I think that I think we're aware of some of the public costs associated with alcohol abuse. You know, when you think of your public safety folks and your corrections folks and so on and so forth, Medicaid costs and such. But it's also quite a cost to our employers and just private citizens and such. So the costs are private and public. And so it's really something that's felt throughout the economy, not just affecting the public sector. And I think when we talk about policy and programs, sometimes we think largely about the public impact, but there is a lot of impact on employers and other people. So I wanted to emphasize that. And I'm hoping that we weren't able to separate out the public from the private when we did our analysis, but when you go through the report, you will see some things that about productivity and so on and so forth that affect our employees.
Senator Giesel?
Sure. I just had a question. You're talking about the impacts, the prevention of alcohol-attributable harms, fetal alcohol syndrome. You know, perhaps the year before, we put out into effect a program that put pregnancy tests in the restrooms of alcohol establishments. Is that something, the impact of that program, part of your analysis?
No, we didn't do that kind of evaluation of a policy like that, but we do capture some of the impacts related to fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and I'll talk a little bit about that.
Good. Thank you.
Senator Giesel, through the chair, that research evaluation of that program was done by the Institute for Circumpolar Health, and those results are, in fact, available. And if the committee would wish, they would be happy to present the information from that. And I'll just tease you with, it was incredibly successful.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, that would be very beneficial for us to hear. It was something that the Senate initiated, and I think it's always helpful to know how our suggested programs, what the outcome was like. Thank you.
So I don't want to get too lost in the weeds on the methodology, but I do want to emphasize a few things here as we walk through it. There's a lot of different chapters and, like I said, a lot of different sectors that we're trying to capture those costs. I think it's really important that we capture the context around alcohol consumption, so I'll present some slides with regard to that. But what I wanted to point out on the methodology with regard to alcohol consumption is that you're probably familiar with a couple different surveys out there, YRBS and BRFIS, that captures middle school and high school impacts and then adult impacts. The survey that we use about consumption is actually through the National Survey of Drug Use and Health. And the reason why we use that data as opposed to YRBS and BRFIS data, although you can measure alcohol through those survey instruments, is a couple of reasons. One is that it's one survey that captures 12 plus. So we're not mixing data sources, which makes our modeling a lot easier. And it also is a pretty rigorous survey. Close to 1,000 households are surveyed in Alaska annually with regard to that. And the survey can take about an hour to complete. And it's done in the household. Surveyors go into the households with a computer and work with the person. It's random selection, and they have a good cross-section throughout the state. And I have some details on that if you're interested in it. But so that's important. But probably the most important reason why we chose that survey is because the new modeling that's available to us is based on that national survey. So it's through CDC and so on and so forth. So we that's why we've used it, and I don't think we've used it in the past. I think it was in the past we've probably been more reliant on BRFIS data. So I wanted to point that out because I think that that's an improvement. I was going to say also in the national survey, the surveyors, when they go in and survey folks, they actually are trained to do some clinical diagnosis type work, which enables us to report to you some data on alcohol dependence and alcohol abuse. And I'll get into that a little more specifically, but I think that also is very informative. Productivity, I mean, what I want to talk a little bit briefly about the methodology around that is that we were really grateful and appreciative of the support we got from the Health Analytics and Vital Reports Division, which used to be the Bureau of Vital Statistics. I still have a hard time getting my head around the new name. Anyway, they did quite a bit of work with us on producing the mortality productivity issues. It's quite complex, as you can imagine, and you have years lost from premature death, and how do you calculate what that impact is going to be? And they were really central in helping us work through those issues, and they have people who are very trained with those statistics, so it was great. So I really, a shout out to them, and we really appreciated it. We also looked at a number of data sources from Department of Corrections, and this year was the first time we were able to use the Alaska Hospital Facilities data reporting system. You may recall that became mandated, I believe, and now the data is going to be more available than it has been, and it's the first time, I think this is the first time our firm has actually worked with the data. Unfortunately, we weren't able to work with 2015 data. We worked with 2012 data, which is incomplete, so we had to make some adjustments for that, but still, we were excited to be able to work with that data set. As another example of data that we haven't had access to in the past, but we were able to. So, anyway.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. I mean, Alaska is different, right? It's just different. And when you use, I'm happy to hear how much of the state data that's actually collected by the various departments that were used. But how do you adjust national data for a state that has, I mean, higher health care costs per capita, more domestic violence, sexual assault, alcoholism, all of those suicide rates, all of those demographics that are, or statistics that are attributable to a challenged demographic? How do you adjust national data to real life in Alaska?
So it's a good question, and we are reliant on these national models, and we know they don't capture the Alaska experience, but there are Alaska inputs that go into the model, which helps make allowances for some of those differences, like around wage rates and population and so on and so forth. However, I agree. I don't think the national models do as good a job. If we had our own model here in Alaska, it would be better, absolutely. But, those models are very expensive, and we had to look at a lot of different types of models. And so I agree. I don't think that they're fully capturing the costs in Alaska, but we're doing our best to put the Alaska inputs in it to capture as much as we can of those costs.
And Senator Machicki, through the chair, one of the reasons that we feel this is still valuable information is that if anything, it makes these numbers an underestimate of some of these costs. And that was part of our thinking, is we wanted this to be a conservative estimate. It's what I call, for those of you that are old enough to remember Dragnet, the Joe Friday approach. Just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. We'll spin it once we have the facts, but we're just trying to get as accurate a picture without any exaggeration or trying to build a number that isn't accurate.
You follow up, Senator?
That was actually, my question was based on what side of the horizon we fall in the report, if we're on the conservative side or the liberal side. And obviously, the numbers are going to be more conservative than the actual impacts in our state. So,
as I walk through the results, I'll point out some of the limitations to give you some sense of why we think it's conservative.
Thank you.
Yep. Just moving on to some other looking at criminal justice and protective systems, we looked at a number of different, again, national data sets, but that use Alaska data, like the Bureau of Justice Statistics, for instance, the National Survey of Children and Adolescent Well-Being, to try and capture some of those costs around protective services. We certainly talked with OCS as well. We're really always, another shout out for McDowell Group, where we work very closely with the Department of Labor on most of the projects that we do, and again, very, very helpful with the work that we needed to do for this. So we were really appreciative of that. We also got quite a bit of data from the Division of Behavioral Health with regard to the treatment costs and activities there, and so that was helpful. And also, they were able to provide some help on, kind of slicing out the Medicaid costs with regard to treatment. We don't have a Medicaid dollar amount associated with alcohol and drug abuse in this report, and maybe in the next generation we will, but it's tricky stuff to kind of separate out, and so, but we're hopeful we can in the future. And to talk a little bit to FAS and FASD, in the past, the work that we did only captured FAS impacts, and now we have the broader spectrum, and we had some really interesting modeling that actually came out of Canada that was very helpful with that as well. So, we're pretty pleased with that, but we know, and I'll get into it, how we're underestimating the costs around FAS and FASD. We looked at public assistance, both from the federal government and from the state government. There was a report in the past, last report, we were able to report some work that was done by PIRE, which is Pacific Institute of Research and Evaluation, I believe. Mm-hmm. And they did a study back in 2010 measuring the economic impact of underage drinking. We didn't revisit that report, with the exception of just making some adjustments of the dollars for inflation proofing, just to be able to freshen it up, so to speak. In fact, there are a couple instances in this report, if the data was more dated, we tried to at least put some inflation proofing in it so that it was more relevant. I will also point out that we're dealing with the most recent data available at the time of producing this report, and I'd like to be able to say that it was all the consistent 1 year. It's not. In some cases, we're dealing with 2016 data. Sometimes it was 2011 data. We just have to piece it together as best we can. So, we realize that's a limitation as well. We thought it was important to include a little bit about the other side of the equation, so to speak, and that is the beverage industry itself, and there are definitely some impacts as far as jobs and payroll go, and again, working with Department of Labor data on that, some reporting of the tax revenue, Department of Revenue was helpful with that, and then we did some splicing out on impacts on general funds as well. So let's turn to some of the consumption pattern data. Again, this is that national survey where there's close to 1,000 households in Alaska were surveyed for this work. So over half of Alaskans age 12 plus have had a drink in the last 30 days. When you look at this chart, you will notice that we have a comparison with the U.S. And I wanted to point out when we do these kinds of charts, you see there's like a little barbell bar on top of each one. That shows, because these are survey data, that shows the confidence interval. And that tells you, like, if they're within the statistical, if there's statistical difference between the two numbers. And consistently, Alaska is not statistically different than what you find elsewhere in the country. And that may be surprising to people, but I think it's this is a survey that's done. I think there were 136,000 surveys done in the nation with this national survey. So it's, it's pretty reliable that way. And I think it's just putting it in that proper perspective. I think we all feel the impacts, and maybe in a smaller community we see them more, but I just wanted to point that out. So current drinking is if you've had a drink in the last 30 days. Binge drinking is if you're a man, that's if you've had five or more drinks in one sitting in one day within the last 30 days. Alcohol dependence is when you have had a drink within the last year, and you also meet this clinical criteria of at least three criteria to suggest that you are dependent on alcohol. The criteria may include things like withdrawal, persistent desire, loss of social, occupational, recreational activity, recurrent psychological problems. And this is where that survey, when the surveyors go in and they're able to delve a little deeper, that they can make those assessments so that we can then we can talk about dependence. And then alcohol abuse is similar to dependence, with the exception, though, it's only one meeting one of those additional clinical criteria. So you've had a drink in the last you're a current drinker in the last year, but you also meet this other clinical definition to specify that you're an abuser of alcohol. So, you know, 20% over 23% are binge have binge drinking in the last 30 days. But again, statistically, we're not seeing a lot of difference with the within the nation. So what does that equate to number of people? Because I know percents are like, what does a percent mean? So we converted that to what that means as far as number of people go. So a little over 300,000 are drink alcohol. And we also have about 39,000 people that are dependent or abuse in the last year. And then with of that 39,000, there's 19,000 that are dependent on alcohol. When we look at, again, using this national survey, when you look at ranking it against other states, this may be surprising as well, but nationally we're 31st for binge drinking, 26th for current alcohol use, 21st for alcohol dependence alone, and 20th for alcohol dependence or abuse. When we look at it by age group, what we're seeing here, again, statistically not seeing anything different, but I want to point out that what happens between age 12 to 17, and then you you see the 12 to 20 estimate, basically the current use more than doubles in those later years of 18 to 20, and which tells you where some of the problem is on underage drinking as far as age group goes. But again, Alaska is facing the problem that others are facing in the country. So the point of this is trying to show where some of the heavier use on alcohol is, and particularly the capturing some of that underage drinking consumption. This is current alcohol use. If I were, I'll talk a little bit about binge drinking in the future when we talk about underage drinking, but just so you know, 5% of the age 12 to 17 binge drank, 13% between the age of 12 and 20, and then 18 to 25, 39% binge drank in the last 30 days. It was also similar to national trends. So this is actually from a different data set. I want to point that out. But this is looking at age 14 and plus, and this is looking at consumption, alcohol consumption, the actual amount. I think there's some pretty staggering numbers in here. Alcohol consumption is often converted to ethanol consumption because there's different levels of alcohol and different types of drinks. So in Alaska, 1.6 million gallons of ethanol were consumed in Alaska in 2013. I will emphasize that that includes, though, our non-resident visitors. So it's not a perfect number that way. There's unfortunately, there's no way to divvy it out. It's based on some of the some of the data for this comes from Department of Revenue as they capture the costs for taxation and so on and so forth. But what does that 1.6 million gallons of ethanol mean? To convert it, what it converts to for the whole state is 14.6 million gallons of beer, 2.4 million gallons of wine, and 1.7 million gallons of liquor. So then when, oh, sorry. I'll take a question. Yeah.
Actually, can you go back a slide? I'm
yes.
Kind of unfortunately a statistics geek.
That's good.
You said that the numbers are similar, but actually the only numbers are only similar until the age of 25. They're lower for younger Alaskans than the national mean or median. I'm not sure.
I think it maybe doesn't show up as well as it should on the graph, but they are similar.
Well, your 12 and older is, I mean, unless 5% or 3% is insignificant to you. I mean,
statistically, yeah. When you do the survey research, you have a margin of error, and it's within the margin of error. It's taking into account the confidence interval at a 95%. Is that helpful?
So it doesn't demonstrates that older Alaskans have the current alcohol use is significantly heavier than the lower 48 or the U.S. mean. But younger Alaskans seem to be below average on usage.
I think it appears that they're below average, but what I'm saying is statistically, it's not a statistical difference.
Fairly consistent across the various age bands, but okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It appears, but it's actually not, but it appears. But I will say this, over time, the underage drinking, we are seeing a downward trend under underage drinking, so we are making a difference in the state, for sure. And it may take a little bit longer for that to really show up in comparison to the national data, but we are making headway. So going back to this report, when we look at it at a per capita basis, that's 2.7 gallons per person that's consuming alcohol, again, age 14 plus. I have that split out of what that means for ethanol, but I wanted to, in terms of the actual alcohol, it equates to, on average, per capita are drinking 24.8 gallons of beer, 4.0 gallons of wine, and 2.8 gallons of liquor. Staggering numbers. But again, when we look at comparison to the nationally, it's not that different than what we're seeing in the nationally, but it's still pretty darn dramatic, I think. We saw a slight uptick in 2014 in that consumption. So I want to point that out because that data became available to us as we were finishing up the report. When we look at consumption trends over time, the height of consumption was in 1981, and we've been pretty much, downward from 1981, but over the last 20 years, I would say our consumption has been pretty stable and pretty flat, actually. Generally.
Quick question for you. Mm-hmm. You said you got these numbers from the Department of Revenue. Is there a way that you know about quarterly, if during the times of the year, to try to help break out some of the visitors and non-visitors?
That's a really good question. I don't have the answer to that. It would be, that might be possible to do, to look at the seasonality of it. It would be based on when people are reporting it and how they're reporting it, and I don't know how that works with Department of Revenue. I don't know how, if it comes in quarterly, month, I don't know how it gets reported.
Okay. Thank you.
So if we can turn from consumption and some of the data around consumption and turn towards some of the costs now associated with it. So the big number is $1.84 billion in economic costs, and these are the broad categories that we were able to capture those costs, and I'll spend some time going through each one of those categories and discussing a little bit more detail of what those impacts or costs are. And again, this does not include any intangible costs. So starting with the criminal justice and the protective services. So as you know, there can be a significant amount of crime that's conducted under the influence of alcohol. And so trying to capture some of that information. We know that in 2014, there were basically 9,400 arrests and offenses that were related to alcohol. And that represented 25% of the offenses in Alaska. We also know that there were about 7,300 victims of those crimes, and that represents about 17% of the crime victims in 2014. So there's also a lot of economic costs associated with that activity, obviously. And so the criminal justice system, we were able to determine that $136 million, many of those costs are borne by the public sector as well. So you've got your police, you've got your firefighters, you've got your court system and so on and so forth. So that's a lot of that is public sector born. And then when we look at the impacts on the victims themselves, property loss, medical costs and those kinds of things, another $58 million. So to give you a sense of some of the crime around this, the number one crime related to alcohol is thefts. About 2,400 of the offenses were related to thefts. Number two was DUIs. Number three was assaults. And then when we look at the costs, DUIs are the number one costs associated with that. About $42 million of those costs are due to DUIs. When we look at victim costs, the number one and number two costs of that are, one is homicide, is the number one cost, $25 million associated with those costs, and assaults is number two at $14 million. When we talk about child protective services, obviously this has an impact on families, and so there's some costs associated with that. We use some modeling to come up with these numbers. Unfortunately, there's not really good solid data where they capture at the offense that they may know that it's alcohol related and that kind of thing. But when we look at child protective services, when a child goes into foster care or whatever, we don't have. The OCS doesn't actually capture the information of whether it was alcohol-related or drug-related. So we had to look at several different other models that are out there and other states that have invested time and energy into capturing that data, and it could be anywhere between 40 and 80% of the cases of children going into foster care, depending on the state, that are affected because of alcohol or drugs. So this estimate we think is relatively conservative, but we don't have the actual data to work with. We had to work with a model.
Senator Machicki?
Just on methodology, how do you determine what proportion of homicides, or how did you arrive at the dollar number for homicide-related costs from alcohol?
So there are some national models out there, and in fact, there was a report that was done in 2010 by the Lewin Group. I don't have it on me. I'm sorry. They come up with attribution rates for different types of crimes. So, for instance, I can give you an example as it relates to inmates, for instance, just to give you a sense of it. If it was alcohol, it was a liquor light law crime, obviously that would be 100%. But they have different percentages attribution based on the crime itself. So let me just see. So if it's criminal homicide, for instance, they're saying 47%. The modeling is saying 47% of criminal homicide is related to alcohol. And it's in the report on page 52 what those attribution rates are. So we're reliant on them, but they're very helpful to make sure that we are not overestimating in certain kinds of offenses and underestimating in others. So I think it's not just across the board, 100%. It's there's a lot of work that goes into developing those models.
Thank you.
If we add in the intangible, this is actually one model that we were able to make an estimate of what the intangible cost would be to the victims. $605 million in intangible costs, that's quality of life issues, pain and suffering, and that type of thing. So that you can see when you start thinking about the intangible costs, how that drives up the economic costs considerably. But again, that's not what we included in our big number. If we move on to healthcare, this is a good example of how we know we're underestimating some of these costs. So the medical inpatient, the ED, and the outpatient data is data that we were able to work with through the hospital reporting data. The full name, I can't remember what the full name is, but you know what I mean. But the medical outpatient data is not outpatient in the sense that you think of primary care clinics and so on and so forth. It's outpatient services within a hospital setting. So if you have physical therapy in a hospital setting, or you get your labs done, or you go see a physician in a hospital, that kind of thing, day surgery, that's included in that figure. So when you think about the costs of people going to see their own primary care provider, that's not captured in this data. And we know that that's an oversight, and we wish that we had better access to data to be able to do that. So that's an example of how we know this is under accounting the costs. For the medical inpatients, let me get you some admission rates on that. We know for the medical inpatient admissions related to alcohol, we know that about 2,200 admissions were made in 2015 alcohol related. That equates to about 10,000 days in the hospital, bed days. In the ED, the cost to the ED was about 15,800 visits to the ED that were related to alcohol. And then when we move on to drug treatment, we know that there were 5,000 admissions for drug treatment, which accounts to 14,500 bed days. Of that 25.9 million, 12.6 million was funded by Medicaid. We got that data through the Division of Behavioral Health.
And the drug treatment, that's just inpatient that you're referring to, or
the drug treatment is inpatient? Yes. Well, gosh, is it inpatient? The behavioral health, is it only inpatient? Doesn't he? I think it's just inpatient. I think it's residential treatment. I'm pretty sure it's residential treatment.
Yeah, Chairman Wilson, it would include the grants that are made specifically for treatment. What it doesn't include is the Medicaid outpatient, because currently there's no way, because we integrated mental health and substance abuse, many of those Medicaid codes now, you can't peel them apart into whether that unit of service was for a mental health issue or a substance abuse issue. So this will cover the grants, but it won't cover that outpatient Medicaid cost.
Actually, I'll just say that we were able to to look at the enrollments for treatment from a 24-hour detox, residential, and we do have outpatient here and outpatient opioid, but that must be through the grants that you're talking about.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. So it includes both outpatient and residential.
Thank you.
Yes. I was going to go back a step. I'm sorry to do this. There are alcohol attribution rates that are tied to different diagnoses for, and so with that, that's how we were able to determine these numbers. So there's quite a bit of detail in the report talking about those attribution rates, looking at a number of different types of diseases, primary diagnosis, and such. So there's a lot more detail in the report with regard to that. Again, a lot of those attributable rates are coming from the CDC. Prescription drug, in this case what we mean prescription drug to treat alcohol abuse or other medical medical conditions that are related to alcohol abuse, like liver disease, that type of thing. Nursing home is not a significant cost, but we know that it does have some impact on our nursing home costs, about 1% of our total nursing home costs. Again, the model was able to help us pull out and at least capture some of that spending. And then FASD. So the fetal alcohol, the way the model works is it's based on the number of children that are born each year that meet the definition of FASD. So that would require some medical diagnosis at time of birth, admission by the mother that she drank during pregnancy, that kind of thing. So we know with FASD that some of those children are not recognized of having FASD till they enter school sometimes. So that's where those behavioral issues start showing and some of the intellectual impacts and so on and so forth. So this $3 million does not capture any of those folks, any of those children past birth, diagnosis at birth.
Senator Begich.
But wouldn't past birth some of those children be captured in some of the other categorical areas?
I think that that's if they have medical issues, and yeah, I would think that some of that would be captured, but not to the full extent of what the impacts are on schools with special education and so on and so forth. No, we didn't capture that.
But just in these categories, they might be, but not in the ones that you're defining.
That's correct. Thank you. Yes. So I think we're definitely underestimating that cost. If we move on to public assistance and social services, we looked at, you know, federal being, you know, Social Security and TANF and food stamps and that kind of thing. The $9.4 million, this is another area where my gut is telling me that it's underestimating what those costs are, but the modeling, we're actually, in this case, we're dependent on some pretty old modeling that's available, and I don't think it just doesn't feel like it's capturing the full amount to me. In fact, if we look at the $9.4 million that are attributed to alcohol-related individuals, alcohol-related people who are on public assistance because of alcohol, try and get that. Anyway, it's about 2.8% of all the federal public assistance that's going out. And then when we look at the state, it's about 2.9% of total state. So it feels low to me, but especially when we talk about how many people are affected by it. But unfortunately, that's what the modeling, that's the best we have to work with it. And there's no other means that we're aware of to try and capture those costs. But I'm glad we were able to capture some of them. But, again, my intuition is that it's low. Talking about underage drinking, again, I mentioned that we did not do the work specifically on underage drinking. Rather, we just re-reported the work that was done by PIRE. We adjusted it for inflation, so around $350 million a year attributable to costs associated with underage drinking. When we look at those costs, 48%, almost half of them are related to youth violence. That equates to about $168 million. And then when we look at youth traffic accidents, that which is number two, that equates to about $99 million. And I think I quoted those other numbers on current drinking and binge drinking earlier. Moving to traffic collisions, the modeling that we worked with here really captures these costs over nine different categories. So I think it's a pretty thorough capture of impairment-caused collisions. What is difficult with this modeling is that, and what's difficult about the data is Department of Transportation does capture whether it's impaired, but they don't capture necessarily whether it's alcohol impaired or drug impaired. So we had to make assumptions using what the capturing what the total impairment costs were, and then making an attribution of 60% of those total costs related to alcohol and the 40% related to drugs. That 60% was based on looking at other costs, drug and alcohol costs, and where they tend to kind of break out. And so that was, we felt like that was a conservative estimate as well. There's a lot of different traffic collisions. There's a lot of different costs associated with that. I mean, of course, the medical, and of course we know about the cars and the damage that's done to property as related to it. But, you know, really looking at the workplace costs when your employee can't show up to work because they've been injured or they've been in a car accident, or when you think about congestion on roads and what that costs to, you know, trucks not being able to deliver goods on time, or if you're on the Glen Highway, people being, you know, 2 hours late to work because of an accident. Those things are real, and they're real costs to the private sector. Many of these costs are to the private sector.
Quick question. The medical here, is this medical separate than the medical from a couple of slides previously in terms of healthcare?
Yes, it is. And we tried very hard throughout to try and not duplicate impacts. So this will capture those primary care and other kinds of costs associated with it, physical therapy, so on and so forth, whereas the earlier medical is just based on hospital, spending in hospital. The biggest, let me go back to this, sorry, there was one other number I was going to tell you, that based on Department of Transportation, know that alcohol-related impairment-caused traffic collisions, so this is alcohol and drugs, equates to 5.5% of all traffic collisions. And of those collisions, so that was 704 collisions that were related to drug or alcohol impairment, it affected 1,690 occupants of the vehicles. And occupants also includes pedestrians. So occupant seems like a strange word, but when you're a pedestrian, but it also includes that. I'm sorry, wrong way. Productivity is the number one cost, economic cost, from alcohol abuse. It's about 42% of that total $1.8 billion that we were talking about. So it's pretty significant. There's a number of ways productivity is affected by alcohol. One is premature death. We know that there's a couple of different ways we can look at this, and this is where, again, the health analytics and vital reporting was really helpful and helped in us capturing what those costs are. I think the modeling is quite good in this, and we're working with really good vital statistics data on this, and I think that $582 million is a pretty good number to work with. Premature death, what are some of the reasons or top reasons for premature death? In order, they go liver disease. In fact, we had 285 alcohol-related deaths in 2015. Of that 285, 191 were men and 91 were women. And then when we look at the primary diagnosis around their death, liver disease was number one. Number two was suicide. And number three was other poisoning, I'm sure the vital statistics folks could tell you this with a lot more clarity, but my understanding is that poisoning can include things like drug overdoses. And then alcohol poisoning was number four. So then when we look at incarceration, obviously you're incarcerated, you're not being very productive in society, and so we know, based again on the modeling, there's about 3,300 inmates in prison. The modeling that we're using provides an attribution of the crimes for the reason of why they're in prison, and we're estimating almost 1,000 of those inmates are there because of alcohol-related offenses. That's not to say that they may clinically have alcohol issues. It's really looking at whether the crime that they committed was alcohol related. So about a third of the inmates were had committed crimes associated with related to their alcohol use. I'll talk a little bit about our drug abuse report, and when we look at that same statistic for drugs, it's a little over 700 of that 3,300. So when you combine the alcohol and the drugs together, it's about 52% of the inmates are there related to their crime being related to alcohol or drug abuse. So obviously there's some costs associated with that. There's costs associated with substance abuse treatment. You know, if you're having substance abuse treatment, you can't show up at work. And so we know that we're looking at the inpatient and outpatient, that there's quite a few bed days lost as a result of that. Diminished productivity, what that means is, you know, you don't show up to work because you're hungover on Monday morning. Or Friday morning if you're a Thursday night partier, you know. Or you can't do the work that you could do because of your impairment or your inability, or you've developed a disability as a result of your alcohol abuse. So that also is quite a significant cost to, again, the private sector, a lot of that to the private sector.
Senator Baggage?
Just a question on the substance abuse treatment. Of course, when you're in treatment, you lose productivity, but isn't there a concomitant increase or lowering of the premature death number and a decrease in the incarceration number, are those captured? So
the trade-off.
So there's a trade-off there. If you even increase that number to maybe 2.5 million, maybe that could have a substantial decrease on some of those other numbers. Is that?
You may be right, but we did not do that analysis.
Okay.
And when you're looking at treating someone and maybe preventing them from dying prematurely, that seems like there would be a good trade-off there. Yeah,
Senator Baggage, through the chair, absolutely. I mean, you're right. This may be an area where you go, boy, we wish that lost productivity was $10 million a year, because if we had people engaged in treatment at that level, then you're exactly right. Some of these other costs of lost productivity and the other more tangible costs would absolutely go down. So I think you're exactly right. There's a trade-off there, and we would love to have this number be very large.
Thank you very much.
And, of course, for medical conditions, this is the loss. This is not the costs of the medical care. This is people who are hospitalized or have medical conditions and the loss of productivity as a result of that. So that's where that number is, just to clarify. Moving to another side of, we can call it a cost, certainly a cost to the consumer, but just to point out some of those things. This graph actually shows you when I talked about consumption, this is volume of alcohol that's been taxed. The tax itself may have changed, but this is actually the gallons that are taxed. You can see it's pretty stable. Consumption's pretty stable over time. I think the peak was in, I want to say 2000. I know the absolute peak in consumption was in 1981, but in recent years, it looks like 2005 might be the highest consumption in recent years.
Senator Baggage?
Just note, it's one of those things that you kind of enjoy seeing, but in 2003 was when we allowed small breweries here, and you see that. You know, you can see the private sector reflected there, an explosion before, you know, people realize they can't afford to do that, an explosion in the tax revenue from, you know, those small breweries before they failed.
Senator Giesel?
So 1981 was the first permanent fund dividend check, wasn't it?
Oh, I don't know.
I think it was.
There might be a relationship there. I don't know.
That's correct.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what happened in 81. It was either a really good year or a really bad year. I'm not sure. anyway, but the point of this graph is just to show you that stability as far as volume goes. When we talk about what the actual revenue is, Jeff already mentioned that, you know, it was about $37.5 million, I believe, in 2015. On a per capita basis, it's important to take a look at this tax on a per capita basis, and there are some figures in the report that do that, because going back to this volume figure, you know, what's important to know is what does that mean on a per capita basis, and so are we seeing a change that happens there because population grows and comes and goes. And so do this also includes resident and non-resident as well. So when we look at what on per capita basis as far as the tax revenue goes, it's $24.82 per capita. The peak in the per capita amount was actually in 2009 when on a per capita basis we were generating $27.98, almost $28 per person. With the change in the tax law that occurred first showing up in 2003, that's where we saw that even split between the Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse Treatment and Prevention Fund, and the remainder of that. So half goes into that fund and the other half goes into the general fund.
I might add while we're on this slide, there's sometimes a misapprehension that because only half of the alcohol tax goes into the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Treatment and Prevention Fund, that that's all the money that you spend on alcohol and drug abuse treatment and prevention, but that's not the case. In fact, the department has just recently completed a new study of that, and in fact, not counting the behavioral health outpatient, because remember, we can't really separate the mental health from substance abuse, you spend just more than $40 million total. Roughly half of that comes out of the fund, but the other half comes out of general funds. So you're spending at least all of the tax that you collect on alcohol prevention and treatment, whether it's coded to the fund or it comes out of general funds.
So there's also tax that happens at the local level, and so we captured that as well, close to $5 million that's captured locally. When we presented to the House yesterday, House Hass, the point was made that Municipality of Anchorage and the Matsu Borough are not on this list, and that's true. They're not. So there's other municipalities that are collecting tax, and so the point is just to try and capture that and recognize that as well.
And I might add in this regard, you might make note of the fact that there is some significant statutory limitations placed in state law that significantly restricts the ability of local governments to tax alcohol separately or to tax alcohol at a rate higher than they tax other commodities, which is also a policy issue that may want to be addressed.
There's also the benefit that comes from the alcohol sector, and that is on jobs and payroll, and so we captured some of those. They're not costs to the economy that way, but we want to be able to include that in the report because it's kind of something that begs to be mentioned. And so with support from Department of Labor statistics, we were able to capture about 2,900 jobs in 2014 related to the alcohol beverage sector, and that includes those folks who work in bars, drinking places. We've got alcohol retail and alcohol wholesale, and then there's the beverage manufacturing as well. Now, there are percent of those beverage manufacturing that aren't manufacturing alcohol. It's about 10%. We are estimating about 10% of those jobs that may be bottling water, for instance, instead of alcohol. But most of those jobs, 90% of those jobs, are related to alcohol. What do those 2,900 jobs equate to as far as payroll goes? A little over $66 million, and how that breaks out as well.
Senator Giesel?
Oh, Just a quick one on the alcohol drinking places. Does that include the tips?
Oh, for wages, if they report that wage, then, well, no. I don't know. I don't think the reporting that's done to the Department of Labor, I presume, is what they paid people. It's their pay. Their pay. Wages would be, or sorry, tips would be over and above that. And that would be something they would disclose to the IRS, I presume, but not to Department of Labor, if I think I have that right.
Thank you.
Senator Chicken.
Actually, Senator Giesel has a tendency to go to the same place I'm about to go. I think the wages are very low, and I think that's an important part of this discussion. I think alcohol is an important part of our economy. What we're trying to do is make it a positive economy instead of a negative economy, right? Because when we flip, I think there's an economic cost of alcohol abuse, but part of the economic cost of alcohol abuse also provides good jobs for those that are trying to set the lives straight of those that are trapped in the web of alcoholism and abuse. So I just wondering how you went on both sides of the fence there, considering.
Yeah, we didn't. We actually didn't do an analysis of the labor force that's involved in treatment and medical and insurance and so on and so forth. We really didn't do that kind of economic impact, full economic impact analysis, I think is what you're suggesting there. And no, we didn't do that kind of analysis. But you're absolutely right. This affects a lot of jobs. Alcohol abuse affects a lot of different types of jobs throughout the economy.
And Senator Muchiki, through the chair, not yet released is another McDowell report that we commissioned that looks at the economic impact of alcohol taxes. And it looks at if you were to raise the alcohol tax, how many jobs would that cost in the industry? Because increasing taxes does decrease consumption. And so that would have an effect on the industry, a negative effect. But also, if you reinvested those tax dollars, what would be the impact in terms of how many people could be employed to provide treatment to people that were struggling with alcohol? And the number of jobs you could create significantly exceeds the number of jobs you would lose. And when we get an opportunity, we'll be presenting that report as well.
Follow-up, Senator?
I'm never going to call economic benefit that's on the backs of human misery a positive thing, and I know none of us are talking about that. I'm just trying to put the report in context so that I can understand, right?
Yeah.
But I do, I mean, I'll divide this out. That number looks very low when you think about the alcohol industry across the state, from tourism to restaurants and package stores and everything else, that the wages seem low.
Many of those jobs are likely part-time jobs as well.
Thank you.
Senator Giesel.
So, Mr. Jesse, educate me. How do you know that increasing the tax on alcohol decreases consumption? Is there study somewhere?
Yeah, Senator Giesel, through the chair, absolutely. There have been extensive studies about the price elasticity around alcohol. And, in fact, the greatest price sensitivity to consumption is among underage drinkers. They are the most price sensitive. So when we have a chance to release that report, you'll see some sophisticated information in there about what that decrease in consumption would be and what that impact would be on the industry.
Follow-up, Senator?
Thank you. Well, of course, underage drinking. Of course, you mentioned that, the price, I think, of Boone's Farm, but that was in my day. what about the adult drinkers, though? Does that affect them? The price, that is, the tax.
Senator Giesel, through the chair, yes, the price, and, of course, the tax is just a part of the price. But, yes, there is also an impact on older drinkers. It's not as great as it is on underage drinkers. But, again, that's back to our belief in presenting the facts. And the facts is there will be some reduction in consumption, and that will have an economic effect on the industry. So we wanted to be fair and honest about that. So that's in there. There are, for example, in Canada and in some states, they've actually not only looked at, but they've implemented minimum pricing, where you can't buy, for example, liquor, where a fifth is priced below a certain price point, in order to prevent there being very low cost, not to pick on any brands, but R&R and Monarch and these very low cost liquors, to set a minimum price, so that you don't, you know, make it that easy for people to consume large quantities. And that's actually an effective public policy to reduce consumption of those liquors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please continue.
Yeah, and I was just going to add, just to give some context of these jobs, direct jobs associated. So it represents that 2,900 jobs represents about 0.9, almost 1% of all jobs in the state. And then from a wage standpoint, your point being is that it represents 0.4% of wages. So when you look at the wages in this industry, they tend to be lower than what you would see elsewhere in some other sectors. So in summary on the alcohol abuse, I do have a few slides, Mr. Chair, on our drug abuse study, and I realize that this report is – this presentation is primarily on alcohol. But just to sum up on the alcohol abuse, again, pointing out that we were able to capture – $1.84 billion worth of costs. Again, we think that that's conservative in the way that we've approached it. Some other number dollar figures associated with that include the payroll of $66.4 million in alcohol beverage sector payroll, and we look at the close to $40 million in the tax revenue, and then the local government tax revenue around alcohol beverage of $5 million, close to $5 million. So if there's more questions on this alcohol study, I'm happy to take them now before I turn to the just a few slides on the drug study. Does that work for you? Any other questions before I move to drugs? Okay. So we again, because we knew we had limited time, I only have three slides on the drug report. The drug report is structured very similarly to the alcohol report. There's a couple of noticeable differences in the drug report. You know, for instance, like FASD is not included in the drug report, but hepatitis C is, as an example. So there are certain other conditions that happen as a result of drug use. So we capture some of that as well. So they're different, but yet they're some of when you read the two reports side by side, they really do marry together pretty well. So one slide here. No, maybe I have two slides on consumption. Of course, at the time, this is 2013 and 2014, marijuana was considered illicit at that time. We realize now it's not, so it would be a controlled substance. But when this is one of those times where actually we are statistically different than what we see in the states with regard to marijuana use. We are significantly higher in having ever used marijuana and are currently using marijuana. Those are statistically different than elsewhere in the country. When we look at cocaine and other types of drugs, we're very similar to what we're seeing elsewhere. At least we were in 2013, 2014. So, how does it equate to numbers? Because I think numbers are helpful. So we're saying in 2013, 2014, there were 69,000 folks who used marijuana within the last 30 days. There were 20,000 that used other illicit drugs. There's a little; they don't add up to 77 because you have overlap there. When we look at people who are using opioid-related pain relievers for non-medical purposes in the past year. Back in 2013, 2014, that's a couple years ago, I think this number probably has grown, but about 26,000 folks have used prescription pain reliever drugs for non-medical purposes in the past year. We have, again, looking at, it's the same national survey that captures not only the alcohol abuse but also the drug, and we know that about 13,000 folks are dependent on illicit drugs. And I pointed out the issue around the statistical difference on marijuana use. So then when we similarly, you look at the cost breakouts by these different categories that we talked about during the alcohol abuse. They're very similar. The breakouts of costs are very similar. Not same, but they're similar. And productivity is the number one cost in our economy related to it. So in conclusion, we were able to capture $1.84 billion in alcohol abuse, $1.22 billion in drug abuse, and if we add those together, it is $3.1 billion related to economic costs of alcohol and drug abuse in Alaska. That was what we consider the annual costs.
And if I could make one point, the alcohol study was not designed to in any way indict the industry. You know, it's as Senator Michicki pointed out, it's an important economic part of our economic system. If everyone drank responsibly, then there wouldn't be virtually any of these negative costs. But the fact is that alcohol is a very highly abused product, and as a result, there are very substantial economic costs across Alaska. But I want to make it clear, this is not in any way intended to be an indictment of the industry or that they are causing these things. But correlation is not causation. We think it is important to look at this because that $3.1 billion is almost identical to the entire fiscal gap that you're struggling with today.
Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jesse, I agree. I mean, we've worked together on the Title IV stakeholder group for the last couple of years now with the bill that we put out, and the industry is just as concerned with these demographics as we are with people that have a primary focus on public health and public safety. So I certainly didn't take it that way by any means whatsoever. It's an important part of our industry. Many Alaskans are struggling with substance abuse, and that's the focus of not only reducing that economic cost, but the social and cultural costs as well. And that's what I take from these numbers on the negative dollar impacts. So anyway, I just wanted to clarify that I certainly understand the value of the study.
Yeah, and Senator Michicki, through the chair, you know, and from the Mental Health Trust Authority perspective, too, is these economic costs are very important. But for us, it's the impact of these substances on our beneficiaries in terms of its impact on their lives and their ability to be productive citizens and to have a high quality of life, to be employed, to have a home, and to be fully functioning members of the community. So we realize that this in some ways doesn't even get to the real concern that the trust has, which is the quality of life of our beneficiaries.
Senator Baggage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my hope, Jeff, and that in the future work you show the direct, however you can, show the relationship between the treatment dollars we spend and the impact in reducing these numbers now that we have a baseline, a substantive baseline set using the same measures in future years to show the relationship between when we invest dollars in treatment, the dramatic impact I suspect it can have on some of these costs to society. You know, you made the comment earlier about geez, if we only did have more people in that one column, the cost for having to be in treatment. I suspect, as the studies anyway that I have reviewed over the years seem to indicate a direct relationship between addressing these issues and in reducing the costs in the long run, both at the younger level and as young people become adults, the older level, both costs and are not just in productivity gained, but in costs reduced to the criminal justice system, to victimization, etc. This is a starting point that helps guide us to that analysis, but I want to at some point see the analysis that shows, however we can correlate, if not causate, show that relationship between the two. So I would appreciate that over the long run. I think this is great work for as a starting point.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
My only comment was that as we've worked through the other issues with Title IV, I'm seeing more and more attention on the opioid crisis. I fear that it becomes the sort of shiny thing that detracts away from the impacts of alcohol abuse in our state, which I believe are undercaptured. I think if you applied the social costs and you didn't consider the acuteness of opioids, right? If you applied the social costs, the spread, I believe, becomes much wider, with alcoholism being a much greater impact in our state than the other substances. I worry that as we focus on the opioid crisis, that some may drop off on their concerns for alcohol abuse in our state. So I just thought that was worthy of comment. It's still easier. It's socially acceptable. It's a problem that many Alaskans have their entire lives, and it has a tendency to drop off when something that is the only word I can come up with is shinier comes along, but it's always lying under the rug, if you will, as the number one social cost in our state. So,
anyway. Thank you. Senator Geisel.
And taking on to those comments, I think, though, if we looked at it further, we'd find concurrent use and, of course, potentiation, alcohol potentiating the drug impact, the drug effect on the individual. So that'd be interesting, too, to correlate that concurrent use.
Well, and senators, through the chair, I think that Senator Machicki's point is well made. Now it's been probably 14 years ago since I revealed my alcoholism at the state public health convention with 400 public health people in the audience, and was stunned at how many people came up to me and said, me too. And that included doctors, nurses, and most of us never abused opioids or cocaine or, well, maybe I won't mention marijuana, but, the fact is, and this has been something that I've thought about over the years, if at noon on some day every person who is an alcoholic stood up and said, my name is Jeff and I'm an alcoholic, it would change the face of how the community viewed alcohol and the effects of alcoholism, because there are so many of us. And that's where the anonymous part of Alcoholics Anonymous no longer serves us well, in my opinion.
Are there any other member comments? Well, I want to say thank you for presenting to us today. We try to have presentations in the committee that are relevant to topics that either we currently have in legislation or legislation being proposed on it. So thank you again, Ms. Logan and Mr. Jesse, for your time today and for presenting. With that, are there any other member closing comments? Hearing none, on Friday, March 31st, we'll have initial hearing and take public testimony on SB 72, Discrimination, Gender ID, Sexual Orientation by Senator Gardner. And thank you for attending the meeting and watching online. We are adjourned at 2:49 p.m.